Hello, and welcome to the final episode of Wise Up. It's been an absolute privilege talking to so many upcomers and veterans in this music industry, and it's been amazing to hear the wisdom they've had to share. I hope you found value in this and enjoy listening to this last episode. Or if I really want to change the way I'm walking, that's metaphorical. For this season finale, we'll be hearing from Cliff Fluitt and Kaya Milan. Cliff is a partner at the law firm Lewis Silkin and also sits on the board of trustees for Help Musicians and the Ivers. Kaya is an artist manager and currently looks after Steam Down and Afronaut Zoo. She's also the CEO of a very exciting new startup called The Floor, which is about connecting creators with their fans in its own community. So without further ado, let's get into it. With the way that I step, I got away with finesse, and the ladies say they love the way I got the game unlocked, and there's less harder working niggas than the days that I rest. Don't let that go over your... I thought we could start with a little icebreaker, and the one I have today is name a new song or artist that you've come across recently and that you've kind of resonated with, and why that may be. I can go first just to get in there. So I came across an artist called Priya Raghu, who's Indian, but based in Switzerland. And she just put out a song called Chicken Lemon Rice. And I love chicken lemon rice. And that's why it resonated with me. How about you, Kaya?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in addition to working in the tech industry, I also work in artist management. So I don't tend to get to hear a lot of different music other than the music that we're releasing at the moment. So I would say that I have to go with the track that we've released most recently, which is called Untie, which came out yesterday actually, but I've been listening to it for the last 6 months, and it's by Steam Down, a band that I manage based in the UK.
So you were there from kind of the beginning of the writing through the development and kind of hearing the master.
Yeah, it's been a journey, and it features an artist from Rotterdam called Lady Shina, and sort of the connection in that space was we did a festival in 2019 and they happened to be on the same bill, and yeah, then the sort of artistic connection happened through there, and it was quite beautiful.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. And they just kind of like vibes kind of hit it off.
Yeah.
How about you, Cliff?
For me, I was actually decrying the fact that I couldn't get any great new music and blah blah blah, and what's my way of doing it. So like you, I've been going around asking people, and I was introduced to a fantastic artist called Fred Again, who has this extraordinary new sonic soundscape stuff as well. I mean, it's new to me anyway as well, and he's on this wonderful EP called the Actual Life Piano EP, which I just think is absolutely great. And then similarly as well, this morning I was listening through the playlist of songwriters who are nominated for the Ivers Rising Star Awards.
Yeah.
So I chair the Ivers Academy's trust, but I was listening to this morning through the ones as well, and I was just sort of blown away. But having only had a brief listen of everything so far, I'm really looking forward to diving in.
Is that something that's coming out soon, or is it already...
So the Ivers Rising Star Award, their nominees were announced this morning, of all things. So.
We'll have to have a listen and check those artists out. So, Cliff, like the route into law, I mean, in like maybe not entertainment, but from what I understand, just kind of the traditional path is you go to uni, you do a law degree, or you might do like a LLB, and from there on, you might do an internship somewhere at a firm, and then you kind of you find your feet and you get into a practice and so on. Is it similar for the music industry, or is it quite different?
Well, I did the boring route, but as in via law. But no, I mean, the music industry seems to be much more about sort of luck, hope, strategy and hustle. And indeed, I had no intention or even understanding of life in the music industry, but my journey was I did do law at university. You don't have to, but I did. That was the first time I'd actually heard about in-house lawyers and lawyers at record companies. And like pretty much everybody else, when you mention lawyers at record companies, people go, what do they need a law? What do they need a lawyer for? I mean, the fact that it show business and the fact that everyone wants a record contract is usually the answer to that question. But everyone asks it, and I indeed asked it. And I was told that these lawyers had fridges in their office with beer in it. That was the thing. And after I'd qualified as a lawyer and I got an interview at Warner Music, I spent much of the interview craning my neck to see whether or not there was a fridge in the office with beer in it. And there was, you know, every office having a stereo in it and offices having fridges and beer and things like that. It's, again, it was just, it's the vibe. It's the vibe.
But like, how did you get your foot in the door at Warner?
I saw an job ad for something in a, what's called a newspaper.
Oh, what's that?
Ask Your Parents. Yeah, exactly.
I'll have
And it just said requirements was it said in the printed job ad, I remember it very, very clearly, must be a qualified solicitor and have a good sense of humour. And I thought, well, barely qualified, but I have an okay sense of humour. And yeah, and I applied and I rang up and they said, your applicant number 350, so don't call us, we'll call you.
Yeah.
And then a few months later, I ended up getting the job.
Kai, I mean, is law something you have an interest in as well?
Yeah, actually, I went to university wanting to study law. I ended up studying broadcast journalism and media law, which touched into in the spaces that I did really want to get into entertainment law, and it kind of touched in the spaces that resonated with me through the media law side of the degree. And I kind of got to use that quite a lot, I guess, in the early stages of my career as an independent manager, you know, reading contracts and that sort of stuff, which I, unlike a lot of people, find really interesting and exciting to do. So partially law, definitely a direction I wanted to go in before management, but yeah, management kind of just falls in into place after a certain period of time and derails any plans that you had, essentially.
Yeah, I hear that. Was it kind of like you just started vibing a lot more with management? And I mean, management's something you have to know a lot about every kind of facet of the industry. And
yeah, I think with management it's something that I knew I had a passion for. I think in during university I wasn't 100% sure what my passion was, and when I came into management I definitely realized that it's a passion that I had. It enabled me to use all of my skills at the time. And also, even though, you know, knowing things is important, it's only really now where I hear people who are going to uni to study music management, because it always used to be music business and now it's music management. Outside of that, it is really something that you've just got to do. The experiences that you have are very much on the job, and no one can really prepare you with how to navigate through this industry. Quite a minefield sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. It's yeah, going back to different hats, because I think that's an important thing. How do you both manage your time in terms of staying on top of all these different activities and initiatives that you're involved with?
Sometimes badly, I'd say. I think there's a lot of things going on, and probably Cliff would agree, you kind of have to be on your toes, especially when working in the industry, because things, day-to-day life is not it's not the same each day. You know, it's not kind of like you have a specific schedule. Yes, you have meetings, but even from a management perspective, I might be in meetings and have to go to a show. I also tour manage as well as work for the floor. So yeah, it's a lot of hats and it's a lot of things to maneuver. I'm lucky because everything does intertwine in some way, but I do think that it would be unrealistic for me to kind of say, this is my day at the floor, this is my day with management. Come in, we're in release mode at the moment. We've got a waterfall release campaign, so we're having a track come out each month. So it's unrealistic for me to say I'm going to ignore everything to do with management today to focus on this. And like, it has to allow me to pivot in terms of my different roles and different hats. So I'd say no day is the same. It does require you being very adaptable to the circumstance, and it does require that you set your own boundaries with your time and your energy. And I think that requires a level of knowing yourself and knowing your capacity to know when you have to pivot to different spaces and what is necessary for, I guess, the goal or the objective at that specific point in time.
Yeah, I hear that. Having that mental agility and being able to tell yourself or to know yourself well enough to be like, okay, I gotta stop doing this now. I've got energy for something else, but I can't do the task I'm currently working on, or even altogether. Like, if I don't stop now, I'm gonna burn out.
100%.
I wanted to chat a little bit about barriers as well. Obviously, whatever you're comfortable with. One thing someone on another episode actually pointed out was you tend to notice systemic barriers the higher you climb in a system. You might not necessarily see them from the beginning. And is that would you agree with that, or like what's your experience been?
I'm happy to shoot first.
Yeah, sure.
I think the answer is yes. I think that, for much of my life, I was inured, and I think some of it's coming from an immigrant family or blah, blah, which is it's down to you to work hard. Yes, the system's stacked against you, but you've got to break through, et cetera, et cetera. But now, as I approach my dotage and ready to be farmed out, what I've realized is that without positive change, nothing changes. So I used to, for example, have a very different view on positive discrimination. I just think it was patronizing and, unfair, where, frankly, that's bullshit. Things haven't been meritocratic if you went to a certain school or had a certain background. And, in truth, now I look around the industry, seeing people, I mean, talking about women have always been a majority. Right, so we focus on minorities, but women are a majority in the industry in life, yet have never been a majority in the music industry. And with regard to senior executives, with regard to CEO levels, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's a wonderful article from the tremendous Keith Harris, artist manager and advocate, et cetera, et cetera. And he just wrote beautifully. I think it was last year in the whole Black Lives Matter thing. It was just,
Yeah, a lot of love.
I want to walk into a room and not, be able to count on more than one hand, and I would have been one of them,
Yeah.
And so there has to be positive change, there has to be positive action, and it has to be incumbent upon people who've got a voice, a platform, and ability to be able to do that and be able to say, what, up with this, we will no longer put. I mean, what I think is tremendous about the next generation, particularly Gen Z, is what's very, very clear is that they're not going to put up with shit, which is brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And, more of that, please. And I'm surrounded by people at my age who say, oh, why are these people so this or so that? And I'm like, good, good. If you had to live with the outputs of climate change, you too would be really pissed off. If you had your education, life chances, compromised by the ability to be able to afford it, you would rise up about this. So I am very, very, very pro positive action, and I'm very, very anti this idea of being meritocracy, because for me, that's priced in hegemony and keeping it exactly the way it is.
Yeah, I agree with that. Talking about like women in music, I mean, Kaya, you started the Sorority House, right?
In 2015, when I believe it was starting to become a talking point, definitely not where it is now, but it was starting to become a talking point, and I think that's when Glastonbury had that whole thing of, the whole issue with the lineup being majority male and stuff. And yeah, I think it's definitely an interesting conversation. I do think that it is reliant on a lot of the gatekeepers, particularly in the music industry and a lot of other large businesses or business and industries, it's reliant on the people at the top to kind of make the difference and make the changes. And it's unfortunate that in the music industry, a lot of the people at the top don't see a problem, and don't see an issue with not having, having one woman in the boardroom or having one person of color in that boardroom, a lot of the time because they don't see it. And I think it really does stem from your immediate social circles. And if you don't really interact with women apart from your wife, and you don't, or your and your children, and you don't really interact with people of color outside of the workplace, you're not really going to see why it's important to have them in those spaces. And I think that's a lot of the problem, because if you go to a lot of these boardrooms and you socialize with them, a lot of the time they don't even know how to socialize with people of color. They say things which are very crass and discriminatory, and there's a lack of even understanding how to interact. So if you're in a workspace and you have to think, oh, I have to think, am I being racist or am I not being racist? Am I being sexist or am I not being sexist all the time? It doesn't make you feel very comfortable. And I think having that level of comfort in the workplace is something that people are striving to keep and hold on to. And so, I'm a person who I like to challenge the status quo a lot of the time, and I have conversations, with CEOs and with executives in those boardroom spaces, and I like to challenge their thought process. And a lot of the time, there's an emphasis on, oh, I don't have a problem with you guys, kind of thing. And it's not about having a problem. I think it's more about, do you not think that spaces should be representative of all people, genders, and different nationalities? And I think it's more about opening up that conversation with those people who are the powers that be, and challenge their thought processes, not just in the workplace, but also outside of the workplace. I don't really expect you to hire a bunch of black women if you've never interacted with a black woman in your life, outside of being forced to. And I think that's something that needs to be challenged, because people, especially in the UK, people are able to stay in their bubbles and not really have to. If you live up in Yorkshire, you don't necessarily have to interact with the multicultural population that is in London. And I think that's even something to discuss before having the conversation about hiring more people of color or who are women. So I think it's more of a, I guess, a global issue, as opposed to, simply just changing what is there, because there's a reason why it is the way it is. And I'm sure it's not because they're, crazy racist. I'm sure some people are, but it's not because they're crazy racist. It's not because they're really sexist. It's because they don't even see the need.
Yeah, it's ignorance.
100%. And that needs to be challenged, I think, before I think things are going to change in any dramatic way anyway. But in the music industry, there's a lot of initiatives, especially since last year with the Black Lives Matter initiative. There's a lot of things that have been done in the music industry, particularly at Universal, actually. Steam Down signed to Universal, so they've done a lot of things internally as well. But what I've noticed is, since then, they've hired a lot of female interns of color. That's the change that I've noticed. And I wouldn't say they are all good at their job. It more seems like they're doing it for a sort of political
Yeah, that's the problem, isn't it?
angle. I think it's a really big problem. And I also think it's not just doing things to make a statement. It's doing things that are actually beneficial all around your company, because you're not hiring people who are going to be the future CEOs of Universal. You're hiring people who are effectively not going to be around in the next 1 year to 2 years. So I think there's something that really needs to happen in the mindsets of the people who are in charge in order to actually make lasting change.
100%. It's frustrating because the resources, the education is out there, but it's that change in mindset that needs to occur at the people at the top to kind of drive the change down. And as you said, it's like, oh, things aren't looking good for our company in terms of a D&I. We should hire a black woman. Like that's not the way to do it. We should be looking at, as you say, like learning to interact with another culture and taking that on board and moving forward, self-educating to a point where they know how to do it and they know what to do and then they know who they're looking for as well, who might be a future CEO, rather than just choosing anyone just for the sake of ticking a box.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, one thing I would just add, I have throughout my career mentored a whole bunch of people. They tend to be virtually all women and or people of colour, and many of them have gone on to greater things. But one thing I have said is that, you know, in a world where firms are in the music industry now actively looking to hire people from more diverse backgrounds, that one or two occasions people said, oh, I don't want to take it because they're looking for a black face. I have been equally robust on that point and saying, you know, when it was open for the white boys from Eton, they don't turn it down. So if there is an opportunity, you have to take it. You have to take it. You have to take it. Otherwise, nothing will ever change.
I see that from both sides, and I agree with you to some extent. But I also do think that it's what you're subjected to whilst you're in those spaces. If you're, you know, chosen because they need a black face, you know, I've been in spaces where the entire team call the two black people in the office the same name, and they don't see them as different people, even though they perform completely different roles. And you could say, oh, that's just a mistake, but it's because you just identify them as the black person in the room. And I think on a psychological level, for some people, you have to be very resilient, and to go into your workplace on a day-to-day basis and have to kind of put on this sort of resilient armor, which as a woman of color in the music industry, I've had to do quite often, in a way that I don't believe, again, that men have to do, because men can connect in different ways more naturally than women. But I think that there's an armor that it gets tiring to wear all the time, and having to ignore a lot of comments and ignore a lot of, you know, sideways language and stuff like that, which you might have an issue with, but you're also trying to save face because you're in the office. And I think that, yes, we should be going for opportunities, whether they're open to us for ticking a box or not. But I also think that we have to, if you're going to walk into that space knowing that you are being chosen because you are a black face, you need to know what comes with that. And I don't think all people are not only prepared for that, but also able to handle that just within their own mental health and internal abilities. So I think if you're going to walk into those spaces, you need to be emotionally, mentally, and like spiritually prepared as well for what kind of comes with that in those spaces.
You need to know how to navigate it. And yeah, and I think no one should be subjected to that. Like it's unfortunate. Well, it's more than unfortunate. It's wrong that it is the way it is. And the opportunities, I mean, my two cents on that is the opportunities need to be made better, and companies need to learn how to do it properly, how to learn how to be an ally, really. I feel like we could talk about this for a lot longer. I'm already thinking of a ton of other questions, but I want to move on to a little bit about music and tech. And so everyone's talking about NFTs, right? I mean, big change of topic here, but they're still somewhat mysterious to me. I get the basic idea where you have this digital asset that remains fixed as it is, and you exchange a cryptocurrency for this asset. And but why is it valuable? Like what are NFTs, and why are they valuable to artists? Maybe Cliff, you can take that one.
So NFTs are non-fungible tokens. They are built on blockchain technology, which has been around since at least 2009. And non-fungible tokens, sorry, the blockchain protocol has been around since 2009. Non-fungible tokens have been around since 2016. So it's not particularly new technology. And I'm sure that in some way, shape or form, it's linked to the pandemic. There's been a huge interest in it because they are digital tokens of scarcity. And rather than being about money and being exchangeable and indeed fungible, what they are about is essentially creating digital assets that have value. So you create scarcity. So it's back in the news. Remember when the Wu-Tang Clan decided they were going to make only one version of that album, and they went to great expense to create this one album, which went for a few million, but not much more than it, I think, the whole endeavor cost. Whereas non-fungible tokens, you create the digital equivalent of that, and it uses blockchain technologies in order to ensure its scarcity, be it unique or one of 11 or one of 33 or whatever. And people buy these tokens. So there's the sale, but also where things get really interesting is the opportunity for non-fungible tokens to be sold and resold, and for an element of that value always to flow back to the artist.
Okay.
So in the art world, for example, when art is bought and sold, there is something called an artist resale right, but it's so rarely enacted outside any main gallery, there isn't the opportunity to capture the value. So one of the opportunities for NFTs in the music industry is there are experiences, or like Kings of Leon had their golden ticket where you get a free seat when any of their headline gigs for as long as the band is together, etc., etc. So you get the first sale, but the ability to capture that resale and to create new elements of value or new digital merchandise or new digital assets is one of the reasons why people in the music industry are really hot on it.
Thank you for that. That was a very concise and clear explanation. So we've seen like kind of Kings of Leon and like other well-known artists get into them. But would you say they'll ever be applicable for emerging artists?
So I'm working on a few opportunities now for emerging artists. And emerging artists, you know, they may be emerging, but the beauty of NFTs is, you know, you only need one. Right, so you've got opportunities for super fans, you've got opportunities for be able to you know, sort of support artists early. There are a couple of platforms where people are being encouraged to back early artists on the basis that their value will grow. Now in the past I've seen about five or six attempts at this by people cashing into royalties, but that for me is a quite an unattractive business. Really, the opportunity to, you know, essentially have an NFT of an artist who then, you know, like if there was an Amy Winehouse NFT, when I first saw her as a jazz artist, you know, in an emerging jazz club, and you I really like them, I support them, and then their value can grow and grow and grow. So yeah, I think there's a huge opportunity for emerging artists, and there's at least three platforms I'm aware of, which means there's probably multiples of that coming to the market that's aimed squarely at emerging artists.
That's encouraging to hear. And I mean, artists need more revenue streams, especially in times like COVID. So if this is something that can help with that, then I'm all for it. Now, Kaya, have you considered NFTs for any of your artists?
Definitely. I think with platforms like The Floor, which focus on those sorts of super fans, I think it's definitely a natural step. A lot of artists don't really know, I'm trying to say this in a concise way, the music industry has valued artists very low in all of history. You know, artists are at the sort of bottom of the totem pole when it comes to the music industry. And it's made artists on a psychological level not really know how to value themselves. And something like NFTs, which places a lot of value on artist value or artist commercial value, it's a bit of a conundrum for a lot of artists to get their head around, because they're just trying to, you know, they're getting paid 0.023p per stream and then saying, oh yeah, but you can sell this NFT for £900,000, and it's like, well, why would Spotify be paying me this little? and then I can sell an NFT for that much. It's not really correlating in terms of the industry as a whole pie, let's say, from merch to music sales and streams to all the other different avenues. I think NFTs has come in as kind of a bit of a weird one for emerging artists, particularly, who don't really see a lot of income coming from their music. So
yeah,
it's something that I think is going to do really well when it really hits. But for a lot of emerging artists, I think they don't really know what is up and what is down at this point in time. And once everything rebalances in all spaces, I think, you know, with this music industry reset and all that stuff, I think NFTs will make a lot more sense for emerging artists. But until then, I think it's very difficult to kind of get an artist to see their value when the rest of the industry doesn't really value that artist in the way that they should.
That's a really interesting point. Like, I feel now that, not within the industry, but kind of on the consumer level, I feel like people are slowly starting to understand how artists make money, and they understand, you know, Spotify or Apple or DSPs, they don't make much money from there. And I feel like we're kind of heading more towards fans being happy to support artists on Patreon and like pay for music, and even on, I'm sure you must have seen, Kai, on the floor, like you see this, which is good. I mean, I'm glad we're getting to that point, and maybe it's a case of, you know, once the fans go there first, the industry will follow.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it's once the artists figure it out, because even with something like the floor, it's a direct fan subscription based platform. If for an artist to be like, what am I charging people per month to, like, the value exchange essentially,
yeah,
is where I think a lot of artists are struggling to get their head around, because if they don't deem themselves as valuable because the industry determines their value, then they don't even really know what that value exchange is with a fan. They're told how much a ticket sale is worth by their booking agent. They're told how much a stream is worth by DSPs. They're told how much merch is worth by the sort of general market value for a t-shirt, for a tote bag, or whatever. When they're asked to place value on themselves, and that value can be anything, they look to, you know, other barometers in the industry to figure that out. With NFTs, it's specifically connected to that artist. That value of that NFT is specifically connected to that artist and how they grow and develop in their careers. So that's a really weird space to be in. And then you're placing that value and then asking fans to pay it. And as we all know, the fans that you might have right now might not be in a space to, I guess, purchase an NFT. But it's the fans that you develop throughout your career that probably will. But it's a chicken and egg situation. And I believe it has to come from the artists and their team directly in terms of their progression and their projections for their careers. And the industry will follow. It might take a while. Right now, it seems like going against the grain, especially whilst the rest of the industry are trying to figure out how NFTs work, how they are going to personally monetize from those NFTs and all of the above. So yeah, I think it's an interesting journey, but I think it requires a lot of value consideration and also a personal value understanding. And I think it's a shift that needs to happen, but it's going to take a while.
I'm glad you shared that, actually. Like, that's not something I'd thought about for my own artists that I manage, and yeah, I think we'll definitely be having conversations around that moving on. Cliff, would you agree, like, NFTs playing an integral part in changing how artists perceive their own value?
Yeah, I think so, and I think that that's actually arguably, I think, the most helpful thing about all of this. You know, they say that COVID is brutal in the face of underlying conditions. And I think the underlying condition of the music industry, particularly from an artist's perspective, was an over-reliance on live. And then you end up in a hopefully once-in-a-century situation where live is kicked away And it really has, you know, sort of cruelly exposed the lack of diversity of revenue streams. Over the years, I've worked with lots of people in the music industry, but I've also expanded that to working with influencers. And, you know, they have consistently pivoted and shifted their business. You know, when they originally started, it was all on YouTube ad revenue and sponsorship. Now, as many of them own food boxes and makeup companies and merchandise companies, as in not merchandise of that, owning the companies themselves, and have really diversified their revenue streams. The same is true of Twitch gamers. The same is true of, you know, look at someone like KSI. You know, he was well diversified before he came into the music industry.
Yeah, true.
So if NFTs are a way of people getting to think about value differently, that in and of itself is a huge win.
Yeah, sort of something you touched on earlier, Cliff, was like how the digitization of the music industry is, there's this democratization that's occurred from things being a lot more digital now. Like you have anyone, your kind of bedroom producer can get their music out on Spotify very, very easily. And it feels like that was kind of the start. I mean, to my knowledge, it feels like that's the start of when music and tech became, you know, best buds. But was there a particular moment you felt that kind of revolutionized and helped develop this relationship between music and tech?
Well, I've got a bit of a left brain approach to all of that argument. Because I think the idea that, I mean, there's some people, for example, at the top level that think music existed and copyright existed in the Garden of Eden and this awful thing called technology came along. Right. And that's just fake news, right? Technology always comes first. The printing press came well before copyright.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, when people say to me, well, you do realize that a piano is music tech. And they go, shut up. So, hang on, you just press a button and some music comes out. Why is that different to the artificial intelligence platform that I work with? To which I get a series of but. So I think that the conversation with regard to music technology is just all ass backwards or bass backwards or whatever they say. They exist in a quantum state. They have for a very long time. They always will. You know, I've had many a rough and tumble from a producer about how daring to work with these new technologies and how digital, you know, real music always trumps that. And like, yeah, okay, as you stand in something called a studio, which is technology, and then you talk about I don't know, sampling, creating entire genre, and there's this thing called EDM, and do you know what the E stands for, etc. so for me, really, the question has always been not about music and tech. The real question is how do you make it create more creativity and more value? And that, I think, is a different debate and a better one to have. But the idea of seeing it in binary just doesn't appeal to me at all. Though yeah. That's what most people do.
Yeah, that's true. So do you feel like kind of just what you mentioned there is maybe moving into a space of like creator tools and like tech that can support the industry and artists is more of the, because I feel like there's a difference between technology in a studio and like digital technology and tech products, but they are definitely linked.
Well, I mean, I think the real question is that it's, for me, I wouldn't say better or worse, whatever, they're just different.
Okay.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of people now looking at, you know, Kraftwerk and Sparks and John Cale before that, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that in and of itself has led to so much more brilliance. Whether or not it's your cup of char or not, I think it's kind of irrelevant. But that's my own personal view.
Kaya, how do you feel about tech? I mean, I'm guessing you're all for it because you work in that space with the floor. But like, how do you see the relationship between tech and music maybe changing over the next few years?
I think I echo some of Cliff's thoughts in the sense of, you know, in the music industry, it's always had to adapt. The tech industry has adapted with the music industry, and the music industry has adapted with the tech industry, and it kind of works hand in hand in some ways. I think, it's always better when you've got a tech company who puts artists at the center of that, of the center of their purpose and their objective. I think there's a lot of tech companies who are quite influential in the music industry who don't really value or put artists or the music industry at the center of what they do. It's more about just taking, as opposed to giving back. And I think that, apart from like The Floor, it's not it's run by people who get it and people who are in the music industry, people who really do, or not just the music industry, but all creative industries and people who really value those spaces. But I think, we're going into a space where the music industry is kind of literally and not going into the open market, and it changes the way the business operates. If you're thinking about NFTs and you're thinking about stocks and you're thinking about shares and you're thinking about crypto and all these other things, there's a risk of losing, I guess, the organic and what organic essence of what music is really about. And ultimately, it's about connecting with people. And I think, as tech grows and as tech develops, just in any sense, same thing with sort of Instagram and TikTok and stuff, we kind of lose that closeness that I think we used to have in other spaces. So yeah, I think we're moving into a different space, and there's going to be its positives and there's going to be its negatives, and I think we're going to adapt and deal with those as we do.
Yeah, like kind of figuring out how to retain that authenticity while having maybe a symbiotic relationship with tech. I think like one example that came to mind for me just then was my artist was talking about TikTok, and I was like, yeah, TikTok is great. There's loads you can do on there. You can find your niche, kind of build a community around it. But then it got to a point where we were talking, and they were like, oh, but should I change the way I'm writing the song so it suits TikTok more, or should I try and be more suited to the platform while maybe losing a little bit of my authenticity as an artist? And that kind of, I think that's something we have to be conscious of, as managers, I'd say.
Yeah, I think there's a huge amount of people writing for Spotify now as well, just in terms of how they're changing the music structure and the sound structure, et cetera, et cetera. And it's definitely leading to a type of music which, whether or not it's good or not, it's not for me to decide, but it's certainly not particularly diverse.
Yeah, I mean we have AIs that can write chart hits now. And I think it was last year, I think it was Warner signed a deal with the first AI artist, so to speak, which sounds mad. But I think AI will have its place, and AI music will have its place, and I don't see it being a threat to artists.
No, it's not. It's absolutely not. But, again, being old, I remember these arguments in the 70s and 80s about synthesizers killing music. Then I heard
Really?
it about sampling killing music. For many years, synthesizers were banned from Top of the Pops by the Musicians Union because of the jobs that they were going to steal.
Whoa.
I've heard this argument again and again and again.
Yeah. That puts it in perspective, doesn't it?
Definitely.
Yeah. If Bowie were alive, there is no way he wouldn't be working with AI music. None whatsoever.
Yeah, I feel that. The last thing I wanted to kind of ask you both was like, what's the best advice you've ever been given? Or like what's resonated with you?
I don't know about the best. Like the first piece of advice I ever went to a client meeting, So I went to a meeting when I was at Warner Music, and my boss literally kicked me under the table. Not figuratively, literally kicked me under the table.
Why?
As I was, oh, I was just, oh, yes, but we're paying him more than you, or something like that. You know, I was just, and then he just said to me, there is no need for everyone to know what you're thinking. And there's no need for everyone to know what you'll know. And that is advice I'll take to the grave.
That is gold, actually.
I would say sometimes with the things that occur in the industry, it kind of makes you question why you're in it, I'd say. And I think something that I thought about more recently is that it's really important to start with self and then serve others. Myself and Cliff, and yourself, KJ, we serve others. We help and assist with people's careers, people's goals and objectives. But it's really important that we start with self, and that we nourish ourselves, that we educate ourselves, that we take time for ourselves, create those boundaries that we spoke about earlier. And yeah, we do that before we serve others. I think that's something really, really important. Something that I wish I had told myself probably earlier, and was probably have stopped a lot of those burnout moments.
It's easy to forget that. It's easy to forget to focus on yourself at times. I mean, it's sort of like in the airplanes when they tell you to put the mask on yourself first and then
Yeah,
your child.
100%.
Well, I mean, thank you both of you. Thank you so much for making time today. Yeah, it was very, very insightful speaking to both of you, and I feel like I know a little bit more about tech as well, which is always good. So yeah, I'm grateful for you joining.
Pleasure. Next time you play a piano, remember.
Thanks a
Bye
lot.
bye.
Bye.